This podcast is part of the Gun and Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of the show or Gun and Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at gunandgeeknetwork.com. Get ready because geekiness commences in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
That line you're worrying about crossing. Look behind you.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 90 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where tonight we tear your still beating hearts out. We force you to gaze upon them with your last fleeting breaths, fill your ears with the wails and laments of your families and loved ones, and then whisk everything back to normal with a big hearty laugh and a couple of timey-wimey jokes. Aren't we clever? Here in the GPR studios tonight, my name is Keir. Joining me, as always, is my fellow soldier in time, Jay. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
Really good. Really, really good. It's been a very productive weekend. And also in the studio with us is Haley. Haley, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm feeling verbose.
Verbose. She's brimming with verbosity. Well, tonight we are going to take a bit of a risk. Hopefully this will tick off just the right people and get all the wrong people talking just the same. Potentially a very large percentage of the internet involved here, because we've got a topic that a lot of the Whovian community has been discussing in quieter corners amongst themselves at tables around cons or in various chat groups and things of that sort. But recently, I'd say within the past year or so, it has been coming more and more to the forefront as a result of some blog entries and some Tumblr posts and things. And since
just the fact that it keeps on happening.
Yeah, or has yet to be really, really disproven. We'll get to that in a second. Since we've been talking about it amongst ourselves for a while, we figured, what the hell, we're going to volley this up and let everybody contribute to the general discussion as well. We wanted to sort of, you know, take off the kid gloves, take a good hard swing at the showrunner that we both love and hate to love and love to hate. So we're going to put the question out there. Has Stephen Moffat ever killed off or allowed to die permanently and succinctly a character of primary importance? So, you know, just as once, under this showrunner, does everybody have to live? So...
Yeah, and I mean, this is something we've talked about a little bit before, and we've made jokes and stuff, but this time we decided to really go in depth and really look at all of the episodes that Moffat has written, the episodes that have been written under him, you know, everything that kind of falls under the umbrella of Stephen Moffat, and say how many people really have died under his run.
Hmm. Oh, and we offered it up to the listeners as well, and made it open for them. Go ahead and take your best shot, see if you can pour through the episodes, because we figured we'd hive mind it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of material to pour over and just make sure that, you know, see what sticks and what doesn't. And Jay, you kind of spearheaded this. You kept tabs on it as people were, you know, volleying options up to you. And with maybe a couple of caveat exceptions.
Yeah. I mean, the first bit of feedback we got, I got into a discussion with our listener, Stacy, Dare to Smile on Twitter. And she put up that, you know, Renette, Girl in the Fireplace, and Ben. Those are the two big ones. Ben from Blink, the detective. And
I think Billy. Was
Billy,
his
yeah,
name.
Billy. You're right. That never sounded right to me. Billy Shipton, yeah.
Ben was a rat.
Okay. But, you know, I told her, you know, both of those were basically natural causes. You know, Renette got old and sick and died. And, I mean, obviously had to, historical figure and all that. But yeah. Billy, yes, got sent back in time, but lived to a ripe old age and just happened to die of old age. Those were not, so I kind of put the disclaimer on there that, you know, has their life unnaturally been cut short? You know, that's what I would call killing someone, is like ending their life before nature had a chance to.
Right. Or with some sort of a circumstance or accident, or in many cases, what a lot of the fan base seems to be looking for, villain involvement.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we've looked over, you know, I kind of collected some of the more widely published or frequently referenced posts and articles out there online, from everything from Tumblr to Reddit to DoctorWho.co.uk and things and all of the places in between. And they all seem to be in agreement that there is a problem.
Right.
Whether you want to, you know, depending on how wide of a blanket you want to throw over it and say, oh, he's incapable or not, there's something going on there. You know, if you compare it against, not even necessarily, you know, pre-RTD WHO, but even under RTD's tenure, mm-hmm. there was a lot of instances where death was permanent. It was often unexpected and it was brutal.
Yeah. You know, and I think that a lot of the topic of this came under a lot of scrutiny under the name of the doctor. When, you know, we get that great scene where Jenny is saying, you know, I think I've been murdered. And everyone was just like, oh no, This is horrible. And we all felt it. We all got that gut punch and we just hated life for a good 10 minutes. And then it was wiped away and we're like, oh, okay. Yeah, I guess so. And then later on that same episode, she gets killed again and we're all like, yeah, it's not going to stick. What's the point?
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people did put that together. Like, I mean, there's some of us that have seen this pattern extend over the ages and, you know, we've all become well aware of it, but this was the first time that, like, in such a short span, people were able to put their finger on it and be like, no, it's not going to happen because look, it just right here, that same thing. And people started paying attention to it there.
Right. Well, I mean, look at, If you're talking about points where a death that you thought was something permanent and did really stun you, take Rory's first death first. And you thought, well, holy crap, we just really got to know the character a bit. He had just started to emerge from that, you know, poor little kicked puppy dog phase of following Amy around. We first started to really accept the fact that he was more than Mickey Jones, you know, Mickey Smith, and that he was not just going to be the boyfriend that you would, you know, come back and touch upon every once in a while when you needed an anchor to present day Earth. Mm-hmm. But then within, what, two episodes, he became the Kenny of the sci-fi community.
Yeah. Well, before we even got to that, because he actually, I think his first actual death was in Amy's Choice. When, you know, he gets sprayed and there's, they really did drag it up because the first time you see someone get sprayed with the acid or pollen or whatever and just crumble to dust, it's like a paper boy or something riding by on his bike and he gets hit and boom, dust. That's it. Then like later on in the episode, Rory gets hit and they drag it out and he starts crumbling very, very slowly. And, you know, Amy's holding him and it was just very emotional. It was just on TV the other day and I started watching it again and I was like, man, this really hurts. If you don't know what's happening.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's something I want to, that's a point that I want to put on a hook. I want to come back to this momentarily, but it's really, you know, we've always said that if you want to write emotional impact, you hand it to Moffat. You know, if you want something that's going to sit there and either because of the staging, because of the way it's shot or because of the, either the dialogue or the silence involved, you know, the lack of dialogue that has just as much impact, hand it to him and he'll give you something that'll break your heart. But does it have the same lasting impact when it's all wiped clean, often within the same episode, if not, you know, by the next?
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, a great example of that is look back at Adric's death, you know, how that was handled. And, you know, the far-reaching effects that that had.
Sure. People are still angry about it.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's
because still they weren't prepared.
Yeah, and it's still a powerful thing. You know, and then you've got, you know, Moffat making jokes about it himself in Angels Take Manhattan. You know, Amy asking, what, you think you're just going to come back to life? And Rory responding, when don't I? You know, I mean, it's become a point where he himself is joking about it. It's not even, you know, there's no point to it anymore.
Right. Yep. Well, that's what kind of brought up it. And it was an interesting originating comment. You know, we've heard it phrased a number of different ways in terms of the way people had said that, you know, he lacks the, whether it's the guts or just the ability to do that to the fan base and take something away from them in that sense. And note that, you know, we said back at the beginning of this, that we're talking about characters of primary importance. You know, you could have henchman number four from the left, or, you know, one of the many soldiers that had taken on the headless monks or something of that mm-hmm. sort, and say, well, you know, there you go. Well, it could even be named characters with a line or two of dialogue. Yeah. And that's when it starts getting kind of squidgy.
Well, and I mean, that was kind of always the first thing that we put on it, is that, okay, if they have a name, you know, if they get named, but, you know, we actually did get a couple of those. And we talked last week about Lorna from A Good Man Goes to War.
Yeah.
You know, here's a character that's not only named, but actually, you know, given somewhat of a backstory, given some weight to her. And, you know, serves a purpose beyond just let me die. You know, she's gives Amy the little prayer leaf thing and whatnot. It's, you know, obviously could have been done differently, but I mean, there was a purpose to this character.
Right.
You know, but arguably her whole purpose was really to die, you know, but it's, I don't know. I mean, that's one that we can legitimately say, here's a character that Moffat actually put some effort into and then killed off.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the only instances we have of one that actually sticks. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can say that that's a point of credit because of the fact that her death was as important as the establishment of the character itself. You know, possibly, the character, yeah. if she had lived, it might not bear the same lasting importance as one that, I'm not going to necessarily go the route of martyrdom or anything of that sort. It's not of that caliber, but it has significance in the fact that she did die.
Mm-hmm. Although it did get eclipsed, because it's right at the same time that we watch Strax die, which obviously now we understand didn't stick, but at the time did. Yeah, at the time it was like, oh, hey, look, he's dead. Wow, that's crazy.
So you take a death that does actually persist, you upstage it with a, call it a, you know, a false start or what have you, death of a primary character to really take that out of to wipe Lorna Bucket out of the viewer's mind for that however long. And by the time we get Strax back, Lorna who?
Yeah. Although at the time, Strax wasn't really a primary character. This was his introduction to the show.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just one of those, like, they spent a lot more time focusing on Strax.
Right.
But I don't know. But I mean, this is one that sticks, and this is, you know, we'll give this one to Moffat. Here's a character that you put thought into and successfully killed off without bringing back. You know, we had listener Jamie actually point out another one from series 6, the, Joy in The Impossible Astronaut. And I had to ask, I'm like, who the heck is Joy? I don't remember. And she pointed out, she's the woman in the bathroom that the silence electrifies and kills.
Okay.
So yes.
I didn't understand. Know that woman had a name.
That's the thing. She did get a name, yeah. But just barely. I mean, here's a character that, you know, has less than 3 minutes of screen time, you know, and didn't need a name. You obviously don't remember it. It's not important. It's not something that sticks with you. This truly was a character specifically built to die.
Mm.
I really think Moffat doesn't have a problem killing the character he just introduced that episode. It's the characters that carry through that he's never going to kill.
Right.
Oh, yeah. If you've survived to a second episode, you're golden.
Yes. Then we will rewrite the time vortex and make sure that you never, ever die.
Right.
Captain Jack.
Well, there's an interesting point, because take Captain Jack, who's established back under the RTD helm, mm-hmm. but is created in an episode that Moffat pens. We've got an younger Whovian fan out there, you know, 18 or so years of age from England, a kid by the name of Jamie, who had written a Tumblr post that said that, you know, it seems like nothing matters in Doctor Who anymore because there are never any consequences. Nobody suffers. Nobody ever has to really grieve, including the Doctor, you know, when it really comes down to it. And there's never anything to be worried about. I mean, take the grief, take the weight that he was carrying about the Time War for years. Yeah. I mean, in terms of the show, years of the show. And then as a result of what's happened within Day of the Doctor, Name of the Doctor, and so forth, that's all called into question. Well, are the characters even cognizant that it even happened anymore, what have you? So does that mean that the grief is now dispelled, or that it doesn't bear the same amount of weight? It doesn't to the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, oh, what pocket universe, Gallifrey is safe, or even if they aren't aware of it.
Yeah.
So this kid wrote, you know, in the RTD era, the innocence were slaughtered in nearly every episode.
Yeah.
Because RTD understood that villains are not scary and are not threatening unless they actually kill someone.
Right.
So what's going on?
Well, I mean, and that's the thing. When the Doctor Dances came out and that whole, you know, everybody lives, that was a powerful moment. And that stuck with us because that was true. It's like, you know, just this once, everybody lives. We had seen everyone get killed and slaughtered and just, you know, villains were there to kill people, you know, and they actually did it. So this one time that the Doctor was actually able to save anyone carried weight. And then, yeah. You know, as time goes on, it's like, oh, look, here's the Daleks. Let's make them spin in circles and act goofy instead of actually, you know, killing anyone. They're going to scream, exterminate, but that's the closest they're going to get to doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you take the fact that and people have been criticizing this as well. Maybe this is a discussion for another time. Have the Centaurans become comedic effect?
Mm-hmm.
Because they are no longer a formidable warrior race of clones. Their catchphrases and potato jokes, yeah, and, you know, clone gags.
The only Centauran we've seen in a while is Strax.
Well, we did see the two in the time of the Doctor that were...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
right, and his clones being blown up in the invisible tank.
Yeah, know? And that was, again, it was just a joke. That was the only thing that it was there for. So I'd say, yeah, that's a valid criticism at this point. Yeah, if you are going to take a formidable villain like the Centaurans and turn them into, you know, a comedic effect, you have to replace it somehow. You know, give us another villain that's worse.
He's going to really make the Slovene a meaty villain.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. But, yeah, so those are the two that we've got. We've got some more. We looked under the entire run of Stephen Moffat and said, okay, this is his era as showrunner. We, aside from those two that we already mentioned, we couldn't find any more that he had actually killed. There were some episodes that did have deaths in them, like the God Complex. You know, I think everyone in that episode, aside from, you know, Amy, Rory, and the Doctor, got killed, right?
Right.
I mean, it's been a while since I've watched it, sorry. But they died, and there was no coming back from that. The Doctor didn't reset the system, and everything was good. Is those people are dead. You know, then we had the Rebel Flesh and the Almost People, where you've got Jennifer Lucas, Buzzer Edwards, and Dickon are all killed by Jennifer's ganger. Jimmy Wicks is also killed by Jennifer's ganger, but his ganger went on to take care of his kid and live his life and, you know, became him. So that one's kind of a gray area.
Right.
And I mean, that's a typical Moffat trick of, oh, this person's dead, but look, they just happened to have a clone made 5 minutes before they died. So
something softens the blow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, A Town Called Mercy, we had Jex commit suicide at the end.
Yeah. True, but I don't know. With Jex, again, Haley's point about being within the episode, mm-hmm, tends to be treated, you know, a little kinder. But then, yeah, also the idea that Jex was the villain-ish that, yeah, you're not really sure you're supposed to be compassionate for.
Again, it's a gray area. You know, you like him at the beginning, you hate him towards the middle, and then at the end redeems himself. So it's like, well, I mean, we're not putting Solomon on the list because that guy's a right bastard and deserved to,
exactly,
die. So, you know, yes, kill, exactly, the villains. That's fine. Nobody cares about that. Jex was one of those that just kind of flip-flopped back and forth. And so at the end, you're kind of ambiguous, like, well, am I supposed to be happy about this or not? I don't know.
Right, right. And that goes along with a whole other issue that we've been having with Moffat recently, which is whether or not he's actually changing the inherent nature of the Doctor to be more apt to let villains die. Because, mm-hmm, there was a time when the Doctor would not even allow villains to die, and he'd be attempting to save them down to the last possible moment and give them their opportunity for redemption until there was absolutely no other option. So, you know, has that changed now too? You know, instances of the Doctor carrying a gun or what have you, and you're like, wah, whoa, what happened to the, you know, to the timeless pacifist there? But yeah, it kind of goes along with it. So now we're supposed to think that it's okay if it's somebody who has committed some atrocities, or is just, you know, in the case of Solomon, just an outright bastard.
Yeah.
So let him go.
Well, and then we've got Lieutenant Stepishin from Cold War, who was not primary villain, but definitely, you know, one of those that we didn't hate seeing die.
True.
And then Nightmare in Silver, we've got a lot of random soldiers and the captain all being killed by Cybermen. But I say random soldiers, I'm sure they had a name, but I didn't care enough to learn them. I don't remember them.
And you never got any backstory on them, so it wasn't like they carried any kind of importance.
I mean, they're cannon fodder. You know, I think they refer to them as such in the episode, so it's, you know, there's no weight to that. So I mean, like,
they were the troop of misfits in the first place.
Yeah. So I mean, all of these under Stephen Moffat's run, but all of them within their single episode, within their, you know, their only purpose was to be there to catch the bullet. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, the viewers are not going to shed tears over them.
No, but we've got some from before he took over the episodes that he wrote under Davies. We've already talked about the girl in the fireplace, Madame de Pompadour, you know, natural causes. Mm-hmm. It's the only death that.
But
we
I
see
would say that death carried more weight than some of the, you know, soldier killed by Cyberman. Oh,
yeah. Well, and that, I mean, that's the thing. When someone dies, regardless of natural causes or not, Moffat knows how to make you feel it. You know, when the death actually happens, it hurts, but it's whether or not it sticks and whether or not it was, you know, something that shouldn't have happened. That's the problem.
Right.
Then we've got Blink. We've got, both Kathy Nightingale and Billy Shipton transported back in time and carried on happy lives.
Causes.
Yeah. I mean, we get the letter from Kathy saying, "Hey, look, I had a great life.
You know, here's my kids."
Yeah. I met a man. He loved me like nobody else could. Blah, blah, blah.
Lied to him about my age. It was great.
So, I mean, both of those, yes, it's like, you know, Sally lost her best friend. And then, you know, this guy that she was interested in all of a sudden dying of old age. It's like, I mean, they both, you know, you could feel them, but it wasn't like, holy crap, why did this person have to die? But then we've got Silence of the Library and Forest of the Dead. And this one gets some, here's some interesting stuff.
Yeah, here's where it starts to get questionable, because you start really wondering, in a couple of instances, about the permanency of a Moffat death. Mm-hmm. Physical death, spiritual death, existential death, you know, or if you're backed up to the hard drive, do you live in the cloud?
Live in the cloud.
Forever and ever and ever.
All right, so the ones that we've got Proper Dave, Other Dave, and Anita. So all of these characters, you know, basically there to flesh out the cast.
Yeah.
You know, the doctor gets upset about Anita at the end, but I mean, really, it's just we don't know anything about them aside from, hey, they're here, they're in spacesuits. Now
they've got names and everything.
Yeah. Now they've got two shadows, and we're done. You know, Miss Evangelista, who actually got saved to the hard drive. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, granted, we did see her die, but she's still there in an altered form, but still there. I don't know. I mean, I've got to call this one a non-death, because everything that made up this person still exists, except for their physical form. But who the person is still exists.
Within a rounding error on the IQ, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the only thing is, like, yes, some stuff got changed. But I mean, obviously that brings us to the big one, Miss River Song.
Okay. Yeah. Well, she had her death, physical death. She had her goodbyes. Mm-hmm. But then there's two things that will continue to quirk. She was written from the jump to be an inverted timeline, so you knew you were going to get more of her to continue. So it's very difficult to be able to understand the full impact of the goodbye when you've just met the character. Mm-hmm. And then the whole idea of the sentient, or not, maybe not sentient, but the saving, soul backup.
Yeah. Saving her personality, saving her to the hard drive. I mean, we actually kind of got talking about this too with our friend Richard, and you know, he argues that River is physically killed. Her body and all of the life therein cease to be. This is an ex-parrot. Therefore, she is dead. Definition, clinical definition, she's dead. I mean, I can't argue that, but, you know, can you really be said to be dead if you still exist? You just change form. I mean, the doctor regenerates. Are we saying that every single one of those is a, you know, death? I mean, we've heard it described that way, but, I mean, can you really call it and say, this is exactly what's, you know, the doctor died again. Oh my God, I can't deal with it. It's no, he continues to exist.
I don't know how, If you as the viewer know that that existence persists, you've undermined the impact of the loss, the permanency of the loss. The permanency is what carries so much of the emotional impact.
Mm-hmm.
So the moment you take that power away, or the moment you take that, power is not the right word. The moment you take that punch, you pull that punch, then you've given the viewer the opportunity to say, or even to start to question, well, maybe this isn't everything.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times before has this not been everything? And that's what I'm concerned about, where we've gotten to at this point, is that does anything that happens from this point on, you know, all of Clara's losses, you know, how many times is she going to fall away from the camera over and over? Does it mean then that we are taking these with a larger and larger grain of salt because we've been conditioned to think that the permanency just isn't there or isn't possible? It's impossible.
Well, I mean, look at how things became with Rory. I mean, the first couple times he died, it was horrible. I mean, even in, you know, Curse of the Black Spot, when, you know, they held it just a hair too long to make you mm-hmm. believe that it was going to be undone. And you're like, oh, this is really it. He's really dying this time. And I just, okay, he's back. You know, and from that point on, it's like every time he died, it's like, okay, how long till he pops back up?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he really did become Kenny. You know, it was one of those things like, you bastard. But we knew he was going to be back in the next episode or something. You know, it wasn't something that stuck. So we didn't care. You know, and I mean, to your point with River, you know, if you run into a character that you have no backstory with, if you have no, I've gone back and I've watched episodes in River's perspective from her timeline, starting with Let's Kill Hitler all the way to the Forest of the Dead. And when it gets to that point, and you see her in tears telling the doctor, you can't change this. You cannot take those times away from me. I'm bawling because it carries so much more weight. But the first time I watched it, I'm like, oh man, that's kind of sad. That's just, oh good. He saved her. Yay. There wasn't a punch. I mean, or not as big a punch, I'll say.
Right.
So, I mean, if you introduce a character 5 minutes into the episode and then kill him off 35 minutes later, it's not going to carry that punch. And I don't think Moffat is capable of sticking with something like that. Like, yes, he's going to get the emotions out of me and he's going to laugh at me and, you know, squirt me with a squirt gun and be like, eh, look at you crying, you little, no. Nothing sticks and it's just not working anymore.
Because what it's doing is it's starting to undermine the believability of the characters. They become more caricatures and less characters because they're not dealing with anything in a believable sense. There was a couple of articles out there that were kind of toying at the fact that the show is losing a bit of its poignancy. While it's popular, it's not as poignant anymore because consequences or events don't play out. You know, granted, we're not dealing with alien invasions or things of that sort, but in any sort of an instance where there's a genocidal news story that might echo something about the whole premise of the Time War, which for 4 years was the backbone of the show.
Oh, how more than 4 years?
But has that been completely undone in a 50th anniversary episode that was more a celebration of what Moffat has been doing with it with the last couple of years, because he basically rendered a lot of what RTD had established as moot.
Yeah.
So they said, you know, there's one writer who said something that I'm really finding a hard time to contest. They're saying, you know, when you cannot deal properly with grief or loss or permanent change, you are incapable of writing believable characters or interesting stories. So as long as the show lacks believable, real characters and engaging stories, it will suffer. So revel in consequences, let your human characters behave like humans and deal with things in that crappy, horrible, snuffly way that you do when things are permanent.
Mm-hmm.
I can't contest that, really. I mean, to take nothing away from my enjoyment of the show.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, I'll sit there and I'll watch something like an episode of Broadchurch or Luther or something like that, where it's kind of gritty and real and death is permanent and circumstances are very much dealt with. You know, the characters are forced to deal with what's going on around them. and it strikes home. Granted, it's a very, very different kind of show, but just the same, if you're going to have an instance like that, a character dying, death is death.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, there's been the argument that, you know, this is a family show, and it doesn't need to be that gritty, and it doesn't need to be that horrible. And, I've got to call crap on that. You know, I want my kids to understand that death is a part of life. You have to learn how to deal with grief, because one day something's going to happen that you're not going to be able to go back and hit big friendly button. We're done. Mm-hmm. You know, and you've got to learn to deal with that kind of thing. And I want my kids to learn that just because something you don't like happened, the doctor's not going to come and make it go away. You know, I'm not going to be able to reboot the universe just because you didn't get the Christmas present you want. You know, just because your uncle, or, you know, just because something happened and you don't know how to deal with this grief, doesn't mean that anyone's going to be able to fix it for you.
Yeah. And it's not something you have to use every single episode. Just throwing out that a character can die every once in a while is enough to keep the stakes up in the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there, we've had episodes, like I said, with the big friendly button that, you know, it just really draws attention to the inability to kill people. I mean, Journey to the Center of the TARDIS.
Yeah.
The power of three. You know, when you're killing off hundreds of thousands of people and then, oh, nope, restart the heart. Everyone's fine. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, these things, they stand out because you're like, really? All of those people, and it just didn't happen now?
Right.
And it doesn't seem natural. So it really puts a spotlight on it.
I think. It doesn't necessarily have to be one of those where, you know, there are hundreds or thousands or millions affected.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to say, you know, you kind of look at this two sides. You've got, well, it means more if it's a primary character or something of that sort. If it's a companion, or if it's somebody who's been a touchstone for multiple episodes. Well, that's one side. But then the other side is when you've got the mass impact, the genocides, the tens of thousands or the millions, you know, that are suddenly affected by a plague or an invasion or what have you. And then it all gets rolled back through one of many, many creative ways. And then you find that I personally find, especially in those instances where it's slaughters, that the moment I see it start to happen, you already know something is going to get corrected. Yeah. By the end of it all, the numbers don't even mean anything. And that's you're pulling a lot of poignancy out of it. And that's why I just keep rolling back to the whole idea of the Time War, and the fact that every time when it was described prior to the 50th, it was such an elephant in the room. It was such a point of gravity that, dear God, can you even fathom the millions upon millions that lost their lives on both sides, and and all were gone, the last remaining. And it had so much power to it. Now, well, there's a few characters that still think that it happened, but we know better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's go back and look at some of the episodes we talked about where there actually were deaths. You know, the God Complex, when people started dying, and it did build the tension. We were worried about the characters, you know, in Rebel Flesh and the Almost People. You did feel that there was a danger there.
Right.
You know, when you watch the, Night Terrors, and as soon as Amy gets touched by the peg doll, you're like, oh, clearly this can be reversed. You know, and you no longer care about it. You no longer feel like there's danger, because you know it's something that's going to be undone. And at that point, it's just like, okay, let's see how the rest of the story plays out until the doctor, you know, does whatever and fixes everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It can be frustrating, to say the least, when you start to take it apart. But I guess one of the reasons why we've been having this discussion is because we're concerned about where the show is headed, you know, and especially in light of everything that we were told or everything that was handed to us as far as the Clara explanation, brings this all to the forefront again, because this is just another one of those instances where you think, all right, are we ever going to be concerned about Clara at this point?
No.
Since we don't really know what happened in terms of iterations through the time stream. So she could continue to die. Or if she ever did die, would we ever believe it? Or is this kind of a cry wolf kind of a bad?
Yeah, at this point, any companion, he's stolen the weight of their death if he does eventually kill somebody.
Yeah. I don't really know. Or is it one where he's going to have to, we're going to have a buffer. She's going to have a nice send off, a walk off.
Yeah.
You know, I'm done with the adventure. You're kind of too old for me. You're creepy. You talk like my dad. Bye. And wander off after 6 or 8 episodes. And then we can bring in, you know, maybe even a series of companions that are shorter stints, you know, kind of in the classic sense. They're only in there for, you know, 6, 8, 10 episodes or so. And then somebody crashes into the sun or something. Make it stick. I don't know. I understand your point, Jay, about there's always that umbrella hanging over that says this is a show that the entire family is supposed to be watching. So there is some trepidation in terms of what they can really put in there. But as far as if they are trying to soften the blow to kid viewers, well, half the explanations that they put in there don't resonate with kids. They're not reasoning that stuff out. So you're just making a mess of the plot for the viewers that are taking a part in some sort of a logical sense, and just giving them an opportunity to sit down after the episode is over, turn to their kids and say, oh, it's all right. Everything was fine because when they woke up, it was all a dream. So why not build back up to it? You know, maybe you don't have to go, you know, right into the deep end and throw an ice pick through Clara's eye in, you know, second episode of the next series or what have you. But if you've got a recurrent character, no, folks, we're not going to touch the Paternoster gang. Don't worry. They'll be fine forever because there's a spinoff in there somewhere. But I wouldn't blame them, or I wouldn't get angry with them if they had a character that got introduced to that during this series, makes it in there during, you know, first couple of episodes or somewhere around midstream, and around the finale they bite it, and I think, okay, that's got gravity to it. You know, this is a serious business finale we've been building up mm-hmm. to here, you know, and give it some poignancy.
Yeah.
So like the Danny Pinkman character they're supposed to be introducing,
dead by episode 10. I don't.
And back by episode 11.
They're going to bring back Ian Chesterton as the superintendent of the schools. And he's going to, hello, everyone, and catch it right across the cranium.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine the uproar?
How to anger 50 years of Whovians with one flying lunch tray. Bong!
Moffat's been reading Tumblr, and he understands. He's like, oh, fine, I'm going to kill someone off, and you're going to hate me for it.
I'm going to bring Susan back for one episode. And drop her down an elevator shaft. Sorry.
I don't know. Some people might be thankful for that. Just saying. I don't know. No, but I mean, you know, when you look at it, and, you know, I mean, we just did a little bit with the Eighth Doctor audio stories. And when you go back to, say, Lucy Miller, that was such a powerful story. And the fact that she died and stayed dead, mm-hmm. you know, she was done. And it just... it still sticks with me, even though it was like, you know, audio, and it was something that I didn't know the entire Lucy story up to that point. So it wasn't, you know, something I'd been built up to for, you know, for months or something like that. It was just that one story, but she was given enough weight in that. Like it was long enough that I actually became invested in the character.
Mm-hmm. And speaking from someone who's gone through all of the Big Finish audio involving Lucy Miller for the 4 seasons or so that she wrote out with it, it has even more impact because their relationship was tighter than, Rosententh or any of the other really good camaraderie partnerships. I mean, it was an amazing relationship between the two. There's even, a couple of stories revolving around a period where, for a couple hundred years, the Doctor is on a planet Orbis and completely forgets, as a result of all of his time there, forgets his interaction with humans again. Lucy finds him again. He doesn't know who she is, and just, oh, well, it's nice to meet you. I'm the Doctor, blah, blah, blah. And she's standing there agog because all of that relationship they've had is lost. And even that hurts because it's just the friendship between the two that feels like it's died, you know? So when you get around to Lucy Miller's exit, when you get around to, you've had a number of instances where we're now getting really invested in terms of the Dark Eyes series with Molly O'Sullivan. God knows what happens if they're going to do anything. You know that she's not going to last because they find these interesting ways of being able to hook the audio back into certain touch points mm-hmm. within the televised series. Or Tamsin, or you hear all the other names, actually, when you watch the little Night of the Doctor moment where McGann is talking about the people he's left behind, and he rattles off the names. He's naming all the companions that he's been with in the audio series. Mm-hmm. But they all have weight because they're all gone, and gone. D-E-D, dead. So,
well, you know, I'd say an interesting way of looking at that, too, is who was the one companion that had the most heart-wrenching send-off?
Like is from, it opinion
from,
poll?
Yeah, from New Who would you say had the most horrible
Donna.
Exit?
Donna. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's because they, in essence, killed her. Everything that she had become, everything that we knew of her was wiped away.
Yeah. Killed her and robbed her of what she had gained.
So yeah, Donna still existed physically. She still was there, still had the potential to be that person, but couldn't anymore. That person was gone. So, you know, even if it's not a death, it still carries so much weight. Because, I mean, Amy and Rory, you know, their exit was horribly effective. Like, I mean, it was just, I was weeping watching it, you know. But because they were together and because they lived to a ripe old age, it didn't have that same kind of punch. Whereas Donna is still there. He can still go back and see her. You know, sure. Headcanon says that he does. But, you know... the person that she was, that companion that I love so much, no longer exists. And that hurts.
Well, you're touching on something that sort of sits or runs parallel with the idea of a character death. One of the things that we as consumers of these stories, consumers of fiction in any format, we want to see characters progress. Either for the good, for the bad, there's some arc, there's some change within the characters that we get invested in. A character death cuts that short, keeps us from being able to see the progression that we had started, you know, that momentum that we had seen start to build up. We thought that they were going to be able to get from point A to point B, and we stop at A point two. The idea of what happened with Donna is you've been rolled back. So it hurts or it bothers us just as much because she's been robbed of her arc.
Yeah.
Her progress.
We got to see her go from A to C and then went back to, you know, back to A.
To exact point A.
Yeah.
I mean, which is what it's insulting to a certain degree, you know. How dare you make me love her?
I think that we're all in agreement here, though, that you clearly need to have death. I mean, it's a natural part of life. And when it doesn't exist, it bothers us. It's obvious and it cheapens the experience.
So write to your local senators. Demand more death.
Yeah. I don't know. I really hope that everything that's been said about Series 8 and how it's going to be, you know, a darker and more aggressive kind of thing is going to carry through in that, and that we are going to start seeing more dangerous villains and, you know, more weight when people do actually die.
Consequences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to see permanence. That's basically what I'm asking for.
Yeah, consequences and repercussions.
Well, I mean, if you guys have any opinions on this, please share it with us. You know, do you prefer the lighter tone? Do you like knowing that people aren't ever in actual danger? Or, you know, are you like us and you actually want to see someone take a bullet and understand, okay, that character is done? Yeah, let us know. Write us in. Write to us. Email. Call us. Use the voicemail. Hit us on Twitter. I don't care. Let us know.
Carrier pigeons.
Yeah.
Release the ravens.
Owls. Whatever it is. Any type of flighty bird. But we do have a little bit of news this week, though.
Yeah, well, we got some light stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we were all big fans of the Five-ish Doctors release
Davison
put together. We still don't know how the hell he did half the things that he did for putting that together and got the appearances from damn near everybody under the sun that wasn't in the 50th. And yet it all seemed very good-natured, even though you could tell there's probably still some seething bitterness under the surface. But just the same. But it will be on a Matt Smith collection, I believe, that they're putting together. Is that the DVD set that they're going to be assembling?
I believe so. I just Crap, what was it? An as yet unscheduled special set featuring former Dr. Matt Smith.
Right. So they're going to do a best of, in someone's opinion, of the Smith era and put this on there because they're probably, you know, the swan song obviously include that.
Right.
So give you another opportunity. I mean, it's still out there to be able to watch in a digital format from a handful of sites, and that's fine. But, you know, I would love to know if they're going to have some additional features specifically related.
That's what I was going to say. I'd love to see like a standalone DVD version with all kinds of special features and behind the scenes and, you know, interviews and commentaries and all the good nerdy stuff that we want. So that's going to be the big news, is when we find out whether or not it's just, here's a special, you know, watch it alongside everything else on the DVD, or is there going to be more to it? Mm. But, and then right about that same time frame, we were blown away by a certain little special film called An Adventure in Space and Time. And that has actually been nominated for a Critics' Choice Award.
Okay. Critics' Choice Award, help me with this.
Honestly, I'm not sure. Now that I'm reading more about it, I'm really not sure.
Hmm. Okay. Chicken on that. Yeah. But yes, obviously, all the kudos have always been due. I mean, we loved the docudrama to begin with. I mean, they could have aired it weeks before when they did, you know, because this was part of that whole whirlwind weekend and everything when it first aired. And it was one of those bittersweet, you know, beautifully, sadly beautiful kind of things that we absolutely adored. And Bradley killed it.
Oh, yeah. Well, and they've got three different nominations. They've got Best Movie, Best Actor in a Movie for David Bradley, and Best Supporting Actress for Jessica Raine as Verity.
Yeah, so, which was amazing. Yeah. She and I'm so glad that they did this because, I mean, Verity has so much lasting importance to the show. I mean, they still drop in little references to her all the time, even in recent seasons. They'll name passing characters by and things like that, just to continue to pay lip service to everything that she did to get the show off the ground. Jessica did a phenomenal job with bringing that forward and making us understand how groundbreaking and how risk-taking she really was as far as a woman in the executive producer position within the BBC at the time.
I mean, I hope that they win all three categories because they really do deserve it. It's fantastic. Granted, I mean, there's some heavy competition with them because you've got both Martin Freeman and Billy Bob Thornton for their roles in Fargo. Mark Ruffalo, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Benedict Cumberbatch for Sherlock. So those are all the best actors. So there's some competition there. You got Kathy Bates, Julia Roberts, both in for the best supporting actress. I mean, there's some weight to this. So just the fact that they got nominated alongside this stuff is tremendous.
Yeah.
So, but then what else do we have?
Well, okay. I don't know whether we want to put the spoiler tag across this one because it's not necessarily spoiling anything, and even the whole nature of the story itself is a bit squidgy. But so for call it what you will, you know, if you need to advance for the next 2 minutes across the cast, go right ahead. But there was a tweet that came out under Rachel Talalay's name, Talalay, who had been given the directorial position. You know, we were talking a few weeks ago about, you know, how great it was they were finally, you know, putting a female director back on the show since 2010. Mm-hmm. Now, according to the nature of this tweet, which has been redacted, but was verified as being legitimate at the time, that she was going to be directing a two-part finale. So not necessarily earth-shattering news.
No.
But
interesting.
Yeah.
We haven't had a two-parter since, I guess it was just Series 7 that didn't have a two-parter. That is pretty much par for the course, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But she had come out in some recent interviews and saying some kind of interesting stuff about, you know, how her excitement level. She's over the moon, you know, doing selfies in the TARDIS and whatnot, you know, to do all this. And she's just really kind of loving it and whatnot. But she's also very cognizant of wanting to bring something very different to the show in terms of what her investment is from the director's chair. So, you know, she understands that the scale of these episodes now, in terms of recent seasons, every episode is just a much larger production. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the creative input and in terms of being able to bring something to the table that sets itself apart, it becomes more and more difficult because everybody's raising the bar every time. So her coming into it, she's got to think about, you know, how the hell do you do this? You know, the whole thing is big and hard and ambitious. But when you're working with what she considers to be a really strong script, which is good news for us because she's a very capable, very adept, and very experienced director when it comes to doing science fiction material. If she considers a script to be, you know, what she would call, quote, wonderful, and she wants to work as hard as she can to tell the story beautifully and, in her words, blow away the audience, that means something more than Moffat coming out and saying, oh, you're going to love it. It's going to be great. It's a cracker. It's the most amazing thing. We're going to completely turn the tables on you. It's going to be, oh, up is down and down is sideways and cats love dogs. And
So standard Moffat spin.
Yeah. So if it's coming from someone else with that kind of street cred, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that with a larger impact.
Yeah. Oh, and then the last one we've got, the non-news of the week. There has been a fan-created previously on trailer for Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And you need to set some time aside for this because it's like 12 or 13 minutes long. But it basically follows the same kind of formula as the, you know, previously on from like Game of Thrones. And it hits the high points so that you don't forget the important things that came before. Well, this goes back to 2005.
Yeah. and incorporates even the couple of webisodes and things that stitch us together. I'm thinking of Night of the Doctor and those things to bring us back chronologically, even, you know, behind, you know, brings us back to 8th, technically. Yes. There's a position, a role, and we've got a couple of folks that are in the industry. Will, if you get an opportunity, you know, correct me on this. There's a position within the production team for someone these days who is responsible for putting those clips together. I forget what the name is. I knew it one time. I had heard it before and thought, God, what an interesting job that would be. Where when you realize, like, take a Supernatural episode and they say, oh, we're going to be bringing back this demon, this villain, and we have to remember this story arc that we left off with, you know, back 2 months ago because we're going to wrap it up in this episode. Mm. So we need a 60-second or a 90-second little chunk that's going to refresh everybody's memory and hit some of the poignant lines to get you all jazzed up for what you're about to see.
See, typically I hate those because normally you sit there and you watch that and you're like, oh, they're bringing back that guy. I thought he was dead. Oh well. Yeah, it can be.
Well, that's the mark of it not being done that well, then. Because if they're tipping their hand and showing you that a character that you thought was dead is coming back, well, that kind of sucks. But if you have some sort of a scene that mentions them or something and gets you thinking about them again, or it doesn't even mention them by name, but just gets you thinking about that situation again, maybe that's a better approach. I think that's why they have somebody on staff whose job is to do that really creatively, so you can get set up for it. It's like teeing them up, and then the episode swings.
Well, see, I like the way that they do it on Game of Thrones, where it's like, okay, we've been gone for 6-7 months. However, this is everything that happened last season. If you can't keep up from this point on, then, you know, go watch something else. And I kind of like that because it's like, okay, we've already covered all of this. You're not really spoiling anything. Let's just, okay, yes. And now I remember where we left off. And you know, that's kind of how this whole thing is done, is it's, they go from, you know, 2005 all the way up to the end of the Christmas special. And it hits the high points. Everything that you need to know is really covered in this. It's great.
I haven't seen it yet. Is it kind of like the "What the Frack is Going On" video they made for Battlestar?
God, no! It's third season. It doesn't do as much to try to explain. It's really just a matter of saying, you know, here's some of the stuff that's gone down. Mm-hmm. They spend a lot of time on Bad Wolf.
Yeah,
because obviously that thread ran through so long. Although if you want to take other arcs, it kind of breezes through them with a little more speed.
Good Man Goes to War, you know, they mention, okay, human plus what? Human plus Time Lord. And then you jump into, you know, River basically explaining, I'm your daughter. And it just fits together really well. I mean, somebody put a lot of time and effort into this.
Mm-hmm. And shows some really good Murray Gold scores to run through it as well. So it's scored really well too. It kind of plays nicely with the highs and lows in terms of the action of what's going on screen. You get your Dr. Donna moments, mm-hmm. which damn straight that better be in there. all kinds of great stuff.
Yeah.
It flows really nicely.
Yeah. So, I mean, you definitely, it's worth it to set aside 15 minutes and go back and watch this because it really is done tremendously. And I mean, you can find it in the show notes, head over to GallifreyPublicRadio.com/90 and it's going to be in there. It's well worth it, but yeah, set yourself some time.
Yeah. And thankfully they do not include, I don't want to go. You get the regeneration burst, but you don't have to hear final words.
Oh, but you have to see the point when Wilford knocks on the glass. That's just as bad.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway. So next week we're going to be changing gears a little bit. We had talked a little bit about Comic Palooza here in Houston a couple weeks ago, and there were actually quite a few Doctor Who personalities there. So next week we're actually going to be taking a listen to some of the sections from John Barrowman's panel.
And because it's audio, we can just assume he keeps his pants on.
Yeah, so this has been episode 90 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, don't make me kill you, because then I'll have to come up with some crazy scheme to undo it, and it's just a hassle.
And this is Kira saying, folks, listen, Moriarty is dead.
And this is Haley saying, you need a good death. Without death, there'd only be comedies. Dying gives us size.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.